arguments are basically only as good as the proofs that accompany them. Now, so far, we've seen several kinds of proofs: induction, deduction, causal proofs. But I think there are a lot of other things that can serve as proof for your arguments that you want to use, and that's what we'll be talking about in this lecture. In a debate situation specifically, proof is essential for the acceptance of the argument by your audience, the judges and the critics, because you are probably not an authority, a real expert on the field that you're debating about, so you need to show your work. You need to give a lot of backing and proof for the ideas that you're putting forth. Also, these kinds of proofs, specific kinds of proofs, can help you a lot in convincing specific kinds of audiences and members of the audience. In establishing a classical approach to argumentation, Aristotle examined and enumerated in the Rhetoric 28 different lines of argument that you could use, and that people who were interested in doing such things should become masters of. He also listed 9 false arguments that we should try to avoid. Well, we're not going to go through the 28 in this series, although we have expanded the false arguments from 9 to about 24, but we'll be talking about those fallacies later. What we want to do now is to indicate to you that there are different kinds of proof that you can use to establish your argument. And there are such things as the use of expert opinion, historical fact, statistics, empirical studies and surveys, testimony, the use of analogy and comparison, the use of popular belief, things that the audience believes, and the use of tradition and traditional ways of acting and thinking in supporting your argument. Those are going to be covered by several speakers in today's tape. But I want you to be aware, before we go into examining each of these individually, that the selection of proof that you use is probably based on your goal, what you're trying to get across to the audience. And I think there are several different goals you can have, and specific forms of proof, to me, seem to match up with those goals. For example, if you're going to establish a concept, you're trying to establish an idea that the audience is going to accept, you want basic explanation and illustration. You might give an empirical study or even a case study to show how a certain thing works, and that will help them understand that particular concept. If you're trying to get people to accept a concept, something they may have known or heard about but don't necessarily believe in and accept as true, then I think you need to use things like statistics, like empirical studies, the use of expert opinion and testimony. I think that will help you accomplish that goal quite a bit. Sometimes you know that the audience is aware of something, but you want to talk about how to evaluate that something. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it beautiful? Is it ugly? I think this is an example of where you can easily use popular belief and tradition to try to establish these things. Now, you don't necessarily do that by saying, hey, that's what everybody believes, so that's what you should believe. Instead, you should be aware in creating evaluative arguments that your forms of proof can proceed from inside the value constructs that your audience already has. Sometimes you're making an argument to predict something, to talk about what might or might not happen in the future. And when you're doing that, I think there are certain forms of proof that fit in quite well. For example, the use of an empirical study, the explanation and use of historical facts or instances. Also, in terms of predicting the future, which is a very complex thing in today's dynamic and rapidly changing global society, often we use expert opinion. Theorists and forecasters tell us what may or may not happen and how we can influence that. Finally, you may just want to be trying to increase empathy on the part of the audience. Get them to buy into something, to feel and experience as certain people do, to feel sorry for or feel affection towards specific people, events, or ideas. In doing that, I think that you can use testimony, especially a narrative from an individual about what has happened to them. Get the audience to sort of buy into that particular thing. Well, these are different forms of proof that you can use for different kinds of goals that you have. Let's examine some of these different forms of proof, which we'll now do.
I want to talk to you about proof. It's an important part of all argument. It is the evidence upon which our arguments are designed. Proof is normally assumed, at least in argument settings, to be of a whole series of different types. I'll just examine a few of them with you today. Let's talk about the first. It's quantitative, it's hard, it's generally used called statistics. It's a quantitative type of proof whereby a person would take evidence that's been generated generally by others or by themselves, and it's usually compiled in numbers. It's associated with arguments from cause. In other words, the reason we say one thing, let's say A, a phenomenon, leads to B, is because there's statistical support that that type of relationship continues to exist with some level of regularity. It's associated predominantly with science, even in social sciences. Hence, it often has what is referred to as a scientific bias to it. In other words, the people who most advocate the quantitative method happen to be people in the field of science and not people outside the field of science. There are serious criticisms of quantitative methodology and statistics. The first, and I think the most important one we tend to find in the literature, is the gender criticism of quantitative method, simply arguing that the scientific bias that exists has been generated by a world of science in which there are voices, but those voices have predominantly been male voices, and the male and the objectivism we find in science tends to be gender specific. Furthermore, there's good evidence indicating that there are forms of reasoning based upon those voices that are not in science, voices that are not Western, and voices that are not male. How do you refute statistics? Statistics are refuted on many different levels. Beyond the criticism just mentioned, one of the main ways we refute statistics is by examining its methodology. Very similar to the problems associated with induction, we would look at statistics and ask simple questions like, how large was the sample size upon which the statistics was based? We might ask also whether the statistics were drawn on some observations that are representative, in other words, that they are alike, sufficiently alike with the part of the world that's not being examined, the part of the world that was not observed statistically. Because if there is a difference between the two, then the conclusion drawn about the design, the statistic that you have, may be inaccurate for the outside world. There's a series of other refutations associated with statistics, which might be asking questions like, what was the design of the experiment? Was it legitimate? Were the hypotheses of the experiment legitimate? Were they the right questions to ask? Were they the type of questions that could actually be answered by the experimental design that was used in generating the statistics? We use statistics all the time. You know, even in you're watching the evening weather projections made by the meteorologist on television, he or she would argue that there is some certain probability that a cold front might be moving in, or another type of meteorological phenomenon. The next category that I want to mention is the category of expert testimony. It tends to be incredibly powerful as a form of proof in debating. It is generally referred to as argument by authority. Not one of the most reliable forms of proof, but expert opinion is out there. When, for example, you as a debater begin to do research on a subject in order to make an argument, you will often turn to some secondary sources. You might turn to a book or periodical article you read, and the book or the article might be written by some expert in the field. And you might claim that just because Professor Jones thinks this is true, because he happens to be qualified, then we should believe his conclusion and, by authority, believe the argument is true. This type of argument is designed exclusively based upon a concept of Aristotelian rhetoric we refer to as ethos of credibility, because the argument says that the only reason you want to believe the proof and believe the argument is true based on the proof is because of the qualifications of the authority. How do you refute expert opinion proof that is used in arguments we might find in debate? There's a whole series of possibilities, and these are clearly only limited by your imagination. The first and obvious one is that no one is really an expert on everything, that we do have a limited amount of expertise, even PhDs in some finite field of academics are going to be expert in that field and not necessarily expert in all fields. And unfortunately, when books are printed and articles are printed, editors are not overwhelmingly concerned about the true qualifications of the person who wrote the book or the article. They're not that concerned whether the expert is speaking in his or her field of expertise. They probably want the person to have some qualifications, but whether the qualifications are precise and limited is not something they're really that overly concerned about. Second level of refutation, which is fascinating, is an entire discussion that we could engage in terms of the whole politics of expertness. In other words, the reason there are experts out there is because we have decided that they're experts. We have a system of sanctioning experts. In our society, we tend to have a system of sanctioning experts in terms of whether they hold advanced degrees from academic institutions. We also use standards like, have they been appointed or have they risen to some form of national office? Strangely enough, whether they actually have a national audience, and in which case, just because someone just happens to speak in the morning or evening or afternoon news would qualify them as an expert. There's a politics to expertness, and people who don't play the game of the politics of expertness never really become experts. That doesn't mean they have nothing important to say, or what they say is of less value than someone who just happened to complete a PhD. Also, experts have agendas. Even a person holding a doctorate in an academic setting might have a specific agenda. He or she might engage a series of articles or books in order to get lucrative appointments to government posts or lucrative appointments to corporate or business settings. There might be an agenda associated with what they're saying is true. Furthermore, the business and corporate world doesn't even deny in any way, shape, or form that they hire experts in order to spin stories that are favorable to corporations and businesses. The last way I think you can really refute expert opinion deals with esteem. It's that experts have a high level of self-esteem, and they tend to protect their conclusions and their observations as if they're their own children. And that level of esteem interferes with truth-finding. Experts are not likely to back off of conclusions that they have made because they are literally their academic offspring. So a second area of proof we find in debate and argument is expert opinion. The last level I just want to mention deals with historical fact. We often draw conclusions associated with arguments based on historical fact. A historical fact tends to be either an argument by authority or an argument by analogy. Let's look at the second, an argument by analogy. What happens in an argument based on historical fact is someone will make an observation about a historical phenomenon that occurred, find one in the present that is like the one that occurred in the past, and then conclude that the one in the present will turn out very similarly to the one that happened in the past. Let me give you an illustration. We could look at the student revolt in Tiananmen Square and say that was a lot like, student revolts that occurred in the United States in the 60s in anti-war protests to the Vietnam War. We might want to conclude that what happened in Tiananmen would be like what happened in the 60s, and that wasn't the case whatsoever. There are other historical fact type arguments of analogy which might be more legitimate. What happened in the American Revolution in the United States is a lot like what was going on in the French Revolution, and they turned out similarly. The problem with using historical fact as the basis of argument is the politics of history. I mean, history is written by historians who tend to represent the philosophy of those who then happen to be empowered. We generally refute arguments of history by turning to a study called historiography, which is the study of history. And we learn that history tends to be very ideological, that historians tend to represent the predominant view of their times. And we know that is true when we keep finding history rewritten. Also, there's a sociology of history. The historians tend to be upper middle class. The historians also tend to be white Western. And hence, there's a sociology associated with history, which gives you a particular bias in historical argument. So what we have seen in terms of proof is that there's at least three major areas of proof. The first is proof by statistics, which we use for arguments of cause, and is easily refutable in terms of the voices associated with science and the methodologies that are used. There's argument by expert opinion, associated with argument of authority. It's based on credibility, and you can refute it based upon the limited experience these authorities might have, their limited expertise, and the politics of expertness. In terms of argument by historical fact, which is based on argument from analogy, we find that there's a politics of history which also tend to make those type of arguments problematic.
Hello. I'm going to discuss the issue of empirical study, its use and refutation. Let's begin with the use of empirical study. Why is it that we use empirical studies in debates? Well, the principal foundation for it is that debaters, while knowledgeable and aware of the world, are not always experts in the field that they're discussing. And sometimes one needs expertise to support the well-reasoned claims otherwise debaters introduce into a particular contest debate. And so expert support to complement the ideas of the speaker are frequently used. This is done, as I said, because the speaker might not have the education or formal training in a particular field. But there are some other advantages associated with the use of empirical study in a debate. For example, the source information for empirical study is primarily peer-reviewed academic or scientific journals. The standard for publication in those journals is that the authors have already gone through a debate process through the peer review and editorial process for publishing in the journal. And so the resulting texts have already been subject to debate. They are more authoritative in that respect, easier for debaters to use to support their own claims. One might also argue that these kinds of empirical studies are relatively unbiased. They are not subject to subject whim. They are grounded in objective reality as almost anything could be, I suppose. They are, in that respect, scientific or quasi-scientific documents, and that they reach a more or less definitive conclusion, which is more effective for argument. For refuting the use of empirical studies, there are a number of options available to a debater. Let me begin with an examination of the study itself. Who conducts it? Who conducts the study? We know, for example, that the Tobacco Institute, a research institute in the United States financed exclusively by tobacco companies, produces studies, and some of those studies reach the conclusion, for example, that there's no connection between nicotine and addiction in cigarettes. This conclusion is challenged by almost all the research from independent sources of information. And so one might suspect that the Tobacco Institute, in its alignment with its funding sources, the tobacco manufacturing companies in the United States, might have a vested interest in producing research supporting those companies and at odds with health information for consumers. And so it might be necessary to identify who conducts the research. But equally important might be who pays for the research. It may be that there's research that's conducted at a major university hospital on the issue of nicotine and its addictive properties in cigarettes. but that research might also be funded by the Tobacco Institute. If that research is funded by the Tobacco Institute, one might argue that the research is tainted because the source of income has a vested interest in the production of a particular kind of outcome from the study. There are also issues associated with the study itself. How is the study designed? What's the sample size for the study? A sample size might be too small or unrepresentative. What's the selection method for the study? Recently, health studies in the United States were criticized because the target population was exclusively men. Only men were studied, and the results were more appropriate for men than they were for women and children. Does the study ask appropriate questions, or are the questions loaded in some respects? What kind of information gathering methods were used? Did only motivated persons who responded to a study, were only their results included in the study, or were all results included in the study? And were those results slanted in any way? After all, one could investigate the science of phrenology and examine the bumps on someone's head. Gee, I'm really smart. But that may be a slanted result. And also we need to investigate how the information is used. Does the hypothesis in the study match the argument for which it's being used in a debate? One can therefore refute empirical studies based on who conducts the study, who pays for it, how is it designed, whether the results are slanted, and how the information might be used for the purposes of argument in a debate. Hello, I'm here to discuss the issue of the use and refutation of testimony in debate. By testimony, I believe that we are discussing personal or biographical narration in a debate. Let me begin by saying that testimony exists universally. The narration of one's personal story, one's take on the world, a perspective, exists in all cultures and it has existed for all time. It has great persuasive power because it is the way in which we create and know, the way in which we make sense of the world. It is our personal and lived experience. This is increasingly recognized as an important way of studying the nature of our social world, of investigating it, of knowing it. And an example of that might be, among social scientists, an example of that might be the development of ethnography and ethnohistories as sub-disciplines in the social sciences. It's increasingly used in public policy making as well. Certainly we have always had public hearings on legislation, at least in a number of settings. The public has been allowed to present personal testimony about the way in which new laws might affect their lives. Increasingly, there's also a movement for victims' testimony in criminal trials. During the sentencing phase of criminal trials, quite frequently victims or the relatives of victims are allowed to testify about how the elements associated with a particular criminal act affected them. This is meant to move the state to deliver a particular kind of sentence, almost always a very harsh sentence, against a guilty perpetrator. We also find increasingly frequently in an investigation of the law, the issue of legal storytelling, the personal narration of authors or the biographical information of individuals affected by the law to prove a point about law's relationship to marginalized or otherwise excluded people in a culture or society. And so this issue of testimony to support one's ideas has great personal power. It is increasingly used in the social sciences and also is beginning to, in a very serious way, infiltrate public policy and public decision making. There are particular elements associated with this kind of presentation. There's a certain structure to the kind of stories that one tells. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end to the story. There's usually a theme, and the problem-solution format for many debates constitutes a very fine theme for the telling of a story. The classic example of good triumphing over evil, a team representing emotion typically argues that their advocacy on emotion involves identifying a problem and proposing a workable solution to resolve that crisis. That the crisis is caused by policymakers of the day, evil, and that they've come along with their ideas to triumph over evil. And so it follows a standard narrative theme. And there's also an issue of style in one's narration or testimony in a debate. Who is the speaker? Is the speaker speaking for her or himself? Is the voice of the speaker a first person or autobiographical tale? Or is it a third person testimony, one speaking on behalf of other people who might otherwise be silent? There's also one final element associated with the issue of style, and that is the elaboration of the speech and nonverbal cues might add to the element of storytelling in the debate, the way in which the story is told, the way in which one moves their body or gestures or where they stand in a room might have quite powerful implications for a story. Now, how is it that these kinds of tales are refuted? They're refuted in five ways. They are typically refuted based on challenging the fact that we cannot debate about a subjective experience. We need to examine the world of facts and that the story as presented is not a representative one. That it is, in addition, not in the context of lived experience, that one extracts an element of lived experience in order to tell a story, and that there's a lot of other information that remains hidden that might influence our understanding of that story. That there is no independent verification of the story. This is often the value of empirical study. It is a combination of the many stories of individuals synthesized by a researcher. This can be contrasted with the individual tale that is told for the benefit of an audience. It's also possible to present a counter story, one's own take on the world presented in a narration, and it's also possible to reinterpret the story. After all, a story isn't being told in a debate simply to tell a tale. It's done for the purposes of argument. That means that the story has to be interpreted to support a motion or another issue that's advanced in the debate. And in these same circumstances, an opposing force can reinterpret that story for their own needs. These are the foundations of the use of testimony in a debate, its structure, and the way in which one might refute the tales that are told.
I want to talk about two additional forms of proof, ways that you can support arguments and how to engage those if you're arguing against them. And those are analogy and the use of popular belief. I don't think these are two of the stronger forms of proof that we're looking at today, but I think they are very commonly found and they can be very useful when added to other forms of proof. Let's start by talking about analogy. What do we mean by an analogy? An analogy is where you take two examples, you compare them, and then you take the known elements of one and you relate it to the known elements of another. So we take something we know about one example and apply it to another example that we're trying to look at and understand. For example, we might say that the current American you know, occupation of a space which some have called it as the world's only superpower is sort of like what happened to the ancient Roman Empire. And so people will be analogizing between what happened to the Roman Empire. Remember what happened to the Roman Empire? It could happen to the United States. And they're making this kind of analogy. Analogies are pretty useful because if they know something about the one example that you're giving, and it seems like the other example that you're giving is sort of like it, it's quite easy for the audience to make the transference of those things they know about one to the other. And of course, the other is really what you're arguing about at that point. Now, it's very important to remember that there are two kinds of analogies. There are literal analogies and there are figurative analogies. And literal analogies are really the only ones that are useful for argument. That's where you're comparing things that are of the same type or of the same kind. In this instance, we would say that America and Rome were both nation states, and so we're comparing them. In a figurative analogy, we're comparing things that are different. And while it has a lot of attractive rhetorical flourish, it doesn't have much to offer as proof. For example, I could say, my love is like a red, red rose. Very nice poetically, but what does that mean? Does that mean my love is red? Does that mean it has thorns? Does it mean it needs to be pruned? The argumentative probative value of that analogy are not so much. So in refuting analogies, make sure that they're literal and not figurative. Don't tolerate any figurative analogies as forms of proof. And also, make sure to point out that if it's a literal analogy, that they really need to be things of the same type. For example, the United States and the Roman Empire exist many centuries apart. Things are different now, so really maybe they're not a good analogy, and that's one way that you can attack argument and proof by analogy. Let's talk about the other example that I'm going to cover here, and that's argument based on popular belief. It's something that most think true. If you can show that most believe what you're advocating is true, it can be a pretty powerful, persuasive, and argumentative tool. For example, we could say that that position and that idea has presumption. In society, in the audience, people presume that to be true, therefore it's something that we can base our arguments on. You can also use it very effectively as an additional support for arguments you're making. If the audience believes and accepts critical, central ideas that are part of your argument, don't be afraid to say that, to use peer pressure, if you will, to try to indicate to people that they should accept your side of the argument. Also, if you base an argument on things the audience already believes, they're more likely to accept those building blocks and perhaps more likely to come to your conclusion. I think in disagreeing with an argument based on popular belief, it's pretty easy to show that what's popular is not always correct. There'll always be some current fad that exists that you can make fun of, that everybody recognizes as silly, even though it's fairly popular at that time. You can give examples of things that were once thought true that are clearly no longer true, that the sun revolves around the earth instead of the reverse. Also, I think you can encourage people in the audience to not be swayed by popular belief, but to be independent thinkers, to think for themselves, to come to their own conclusion. Don't let other people teach you how to think. Most audiences like to believe that they're independent and they think for themselves. And I think in overcoming an argument based on popular belief, that's one of the strategies that you can use. I want to talk now about using tradition as a way to support your arguments. Throughout history, we've often said that we should continue to do things the way we have been because we've always done it that way. We know a lot about it. Of course, this applies to many given examples. For example, we might say that we've always planted wheat in Vermont at a certain time of year, and therefore that's the time of year that we should continue to plant wheat. Or in terms of workplace procedures, we can say we've always divided the tasks in this particular workplace up in this way, so we should continue to do it that way. As well, we sometimes use tradition to support arguments about society and people's place in it. For example, an argument has been made that women's roles in society should continue the way they have traditionally been because that's the way we've always done it. Sometimes argument from tradition works fairly well. Sometimes it doesn't work so well. And I want to talk to you about the logical basis behind making arguments supported by tradition, how to analyze and refute arguments based on a tradition, and some summaries about what big ideas we should keep in mind when we're using arguments based on tradition to support our points. Let's talk about the logical basis for making arguments based on tradition. We don't have to say tradition, we could just say previous experience or history. Well, we have experience with something. We know if we do it in this particular way, what's going to happen. We know that it works. We know how it works. Often there aren't that many unforeseen risks. If we've done something over and over again the same way, we pretty much have a good idea of what's going to happen and what the results are going to be, and we're not concerned about a bunch of unforeseen circumstances. That's the whole issue of using experience. We know how it works, and we know what's likely to happen. If the idea that we're talking about has social implications, then we know how people are likely to react, to continue doing things a certain way. Or we also know that they might react adversely to unforeseen changes in the way we do things. Many times in our society, we have rituals. Not elaborate or sacred rituals, but basic rituals that we use over and over again that lead to social cohesion. When we do things the same way over and over again, many of us, it creates a sort of social belongingness. Therefore, we all engage in the same behaviors. It gives us a commonality and kind of a feeling of fellowship. These are all ways in which we can try to use arguments based on tradition. We have experience. We know what the results will be. There aren't that many unforeseen circumstances. We know how people are likely to react to the use of a continuous mode of action. Let's look at some examples. We know that if in Vermont, if we plant wheat at a certain time, it will grow to its maximum extent. We will get the maximum extent. We will get the maximum yield. It won't be too early, so the sprouts won't be killed by frost. We'll be able to harvest it in time. And in Vermont, we have a fairly short growing season. And we can maximize our wheat production based on planting it at a certain time. In the workplace, we may say that we should keep certain modes of behavior, certain divisions of labor, because that's the way we've been doing it. We know what the results are. It seems to be productive. It seems to work. Let's continue to do it. Let me use the more controversial example of women's role in society to try to talk about the social aspects of it. We can argue that if certain genders have certain roles and those roles are continued, then things will continue as they currently are. They won't get worse. And people's social reactions will be predictable. They are used to certain roles, they can continue in those certain roles, and they can build a sort of cohesion because people like to know what their place is, what's expected of them, what they're supposed to do. I'm not saying that all three of these arguments are equally strong. I'm just saying that all three of these examples demonstrate how we use argument based on tradition. With that in mind, let's talk about how to analyze, critique, or refute arguments based on tradition. When is an argument based on tradition or history or experience not a particularly good argument? Well, tradition breaks down when things change. When attitudes that people have change, then that tradition is no longer as applicable. The argument, well, we know what's going to happen and we know that it works, is not as true when things change. Society can change. The morals that we have can change. The factual realities of the situation can change. We have constantly evolving technology, and scientific advance. These are all things that can change. And when the situation changes, then the arguments based on tradition and history are not nearly as strong. We can't say that we know it will work, we have experience, there won't be any unforeseen risks, when the conditions that exist now are different than they were in the past. Also, we need to realize that just because we've done things over and over again doesn't mean that they're particularly good. We can think of many social traditions which, for example, are not particularly good. Slavery has existed for most of human history, yet it would be difficult for us to say that we should continue enslaving millions of people just because we've always done it that way. Absent some compelling rationale to continue tradition, it may not be worthwhile. And if there is compelling rationale against continuing a tradition, then perhaps we shouldn't. If we always default to tradition or history or the way we've done things, we're not likely to make any progress. Now, there's always some risk involved in doing things differently, in doing new things. The first time you ever rode a bicycle, there was a risk that you might fall off. But nevertheless, you tried it, you learned how to do it, and the tradition of not riding a bicycle was overturned. That doesn't mean, for example, that we would abandon tradition for some minor reason or for no reason at all. Currently in society, we have something that's been termed the myth of progress, that if it's new, it must be better. Progress products are constantly sold to us with the argument that it's new, it's improved, it's different. But usually they don't mention how it's new and improved and how it's different and how it's better. Just because something is new doesn't mean that we should adopt it. Just as we should realize that just because something is traditional, it doesn't mean that we should keep it. Let's look at a couple of these examples to explain this. For example, we've always planted wheat in Vermont at the same date. That may no longer be applicable because the climate is changing. It's getting warmer in Vermont. Because the conditions have changed, our tradition is no longer applicable. What about division of work tasks on the job? Well, jobs have changed, the economy has changed, technology has changed, the customer base and the products that are involved have probably changed too. And that might overturn argument from tradition. What about our previous argument that's saying that women's role in society has traditionally been such and such and so we should continue that? Well, society is different. The morals of individuals are different. The kinds of expectations that people have about their lives are different. So we can't say that in any of these examples, tradition is by itself a reason why we should continue doing something the way we always have. When you use arguments from tradition, I think you need to keep in mind how it relates to the audience. How important is this traditional practice to them? What are the risks that they're willing to take? But ultimately, logically, we need to analyze these arguments by saying, how does this appeal to tradition? We should continue doing something because we've always done it that way or traditionally done it that way. Apply to those logical tests that we have given. Arguments from experience and tradition can be powerful arguments, or they can be completely fallacious. It's up to you to analyze them properly to illustrate whether they are worth believing in or worth rejecting.